sound test here.
Okay.
If I can hear you, yeah. Okay. So today is May 1st, 2014.
Wow.
And I know, where did April go? And this is Karen Brewster, and I'm here with Dr. Lou Shapiro in his office in the Geophysical Institute on the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus in Fairbanks, Alaska. Do a little talking about his work with sea ice up in Barrow and the northern coast. Thank you, Lou.
Quite welcome.
Right. Before we get into the meat of the sea ice stuff, maybe you can just give a little background about yourself personally, you know, when and where you were born.
Oh, my gosh. I was born in Bronx, New York. You want my birthday, too?
Yeah, if you don't mind.
October 23rd, 1934.
Okay.
Which makes me old.
No. I don't think so. It makes you seasoned. So what was your growing up like?
I grew up in the Bronx. A kid in the East Bronx. Went to school and so on. Went in the Army in 1953, fall of 53. I was a little too young to catch the Korean War, but I went in 1953, stayed in for 4 years, got out in 57, went to work in Arizona, you know, drilling and mining, but wound up with hepatitis back in New York. And from there, I went to college, started school, South Dakota School of Mines and Technology in Rapid City. I started there and the winter quarter at the end of 1957. Graduated from there in 62. Met my wife while I was there, my future wife. Then went to the University of Minnesota to work on a PhD. Started 62. Took a long time to finish it because I went back to the School of Mines to South Dakota and worked there on research projects and teaching. And finally finished in 71. Finished the PhD in 71 and moved to Alaska immediately after. Came here and got here on July 1st, I think it was, or July, well, probably the end of June in 1971.
And what was your PhD research?
Geology.
It was geology.
Yeah, working on the Black Hills, structural geology in the Black Hills, South Dakota. Been here ever since.
And why did you decide to come here?
Well, for one thing, I was looking for a job. And so, you know, there were at that time, there were not a great many jobs around. But I came up here at a time when they were just starting into remote sensing, and I had done a little bit of that when I was in South Dakota. And so I sort of fit in right away with some of the things they were interested in. But what I was really interested in was seismology and tectonics and geology. But about 3 years into the time here, the interest in sea ice started picking up, and I was always interested in the idea of trying to think about or look at the mechanical properties of natural materials. And so that got me interested in trying to do things in sea ice. And once you get into that, why, it just sort of blossomed. It was the right time to get into it because the oil companies were interested. There was a huge amount of work going on. OCSEP program started up then. That was looking to write, basically to learn more about ice in the offshore environment of the Arctic.
So OCSEP stands for?
Oh, Outer Continental Shelf Environmental Assessment Program, OCSEAP. And that was, we had a big part of that program here that was run by Gunter Weller and Dave Norton. And Gunter was the driving force behind that. Mm-hmm. He did a great job with it.
And so that provided funding for research?
It was funding, yeah. It was a lot of funding because there was just this huge interest in a lot of different things to look at right away. Mm-hmm. There have been people working here for years and years before that, but not at that level of effort and not with the immediacy, with what people perceived as the immediate need to understand more about the environment, about the ice environment, including engineering problems. Because everybody was going to go offshore and drill. And it was a scary sort of thing to think about. They've been drilling structures offshore in Cook Inlet, dealing mm-hmm. with ice down there, but that's nothing like the Arctic. I mean, the Arctic environment is much more difficult in terms of ice.
Right.
So it created this great need to learn an awful lot of practical sorts of things in a hurry. And at the same time, you had to worry about the long term, because you're going to be drilling offshore and there's potential for spills and all sorts of environmental issues to look at, effects on wildlife and so on, and the general environment and whatnot. So there was a lot of work to be done in a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what the OCSEP program did. It was a very broad program. Interestingly, it didn't have a sea ice component when it first started. I mean, people tried to tell BLM, Bureau of Land Management, were running it. They tried to, and I think it was BLM at that time again. They tried to tell them that they needed to understand something about ice, but they weren't interested. They couldn't do that until the summer of 1975, which was the year that the ice never went out.
Okay.
The ice stayed very close to the shore all summer long, and the oceanographers going up there, the ships were going up, and people were trying to do things, and they couldn't get any place because the ice was in the way. So I always tell people that if 1975 had been a light ice year, there would never have been a sea ice program. They wouldn't have needed it, or they wouldn't have realized right. that they needed it. But that drove it home to everybody that they needed to understand more about sea ice. And so that was really the thing that started an awful lot of the longer-term sea ice work up there.
And so that showed OCSEP that...
It just showed people that they needed to know it.
Right.
That there was more to it than that, because they didn't, people didn't understand it.
Right.
I mean, other than people who had been working up there for years. I mean, a lot of people had been out on T3 and studying, ice islands and whatnot, and there'd been a fair amount of work done up there, but never with the level of effort that was needed and the continuity.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly at ice.
Well, and I was wondering, are they looking at it from a different perspective? Was the type of research being done on T3 and those ice mm-hmm. islands, were they looking at different aspects?
Well, they
of
weren't
the
doing
ice?
So much ice. They were using the ice as a platform
yeah.
to do other things. But there were people that were looking at ice. I mean, Hal Payton, who was on the staff here in Institute of Northern Engineering here, I think it was, he'd worked on ice in Cook Inlet, and he'd done work up there
mm-hmm.
also. And so... I mean, there were people were doing things. It was just that the people in the in BLM and the organizations that needed to know this stuff didn't realize how much they needed
mm-hmm.
to know. But I think the engineers and the oil company engineers might have understood. People who are going to have to design
right.
knew
well,
they
I was
needed.
Thinking that it was the earlier days. People were looking at different things related to the ice versus once
yeah.
75 came along. You looked at it from a yeah. different perspective. Because wasn't there the Ajax project?
Ajax was also Ajax was earlier. And that was, again, looking at, larger scale mechanics. But, again, I don't know that the people in BLM appreciated that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Ajax was run, let's see, I think their first, I don't know, there are other people around it. Nobody here was involved in it, and I was not involved in it. I was just there when they were doing it.
I can't remember the dates of it.
Well, I think it was 72 was the first one, and the main deployment, I think, was 74, 74,
okay.
74
and 75. And I can't remember what it stands for.
Ajax, Arctic Ice Dynamics Joint Experiment. Yeah.
Okay. And Wintersteiner, wasn't
yeah,
he?
Norbert, yeah, Norbert did that. Norbert yeah. was the guy who ran it.
Right.
No, it was a very good program.
Yeah.
But it was what really took it off, let's say, was the fact that people who were trying to do these things for OCSEP suddenly mm-hmm. realized they couldn't do it.
So you started doing it with OCSEP. So what was it that you started researching?
Oh, just mainly, two things. From Sea Grant, by the way, which was actually funded mainly by oil companies, that was started in, 73, 74. We've had that little radar that was put up at Barrow.
Mm-hmm.
That was done by Bill Sackinger and Jim Rogers, who were on the faculty staff here at the time. And they put it up. So we were looking at near shore stuff around Barrow, using the radar to look at what might be going on close to shore. They dropped off. When the OCSEP program came along, I took that over. Use the radar mainly just to monitor nearshore things, because we were interested in how the ice shoves, ice pushes along the shore, ridging close to shore, things like that, the sort of nearshore dynamics that we could look at using that radar, which only looked out about 3 miles. It was
mm-hmm.
not particularly, and we recorded this stuff on 35 millimeter film, single framing it every 2.5 minutes or something, photographing the radar screen every 2.5 mm-hmm. minutes, and then developing the film, get the film back every 3 days and develop it, which we had a big lab downstairs here that used to do
that. Yeah, I remember I've seen you showing some of that old footage, and it was interesting. Yeah. And I wondered why, how you guys came up with that. Nowadays, everybody uses all this advanced technology, but
It was actually Bill Sackinger and Rogers that planned the thing and built it. They actually put it up. Mm-hmm. They were both electrical engineers. And C. Grant funded the initial one. Mm-hmm. And then I ran it. When they dropped off, I ran it under Alcep for 5 years or so. But mainly, it was just kind of do the film, develop it, and catalog it. And we tried to put together this little representative movie to show what we learned from what you could see from it.
Mm-hmm. And so what did you learn? What could you see?
Well, basically, we picked up several instances of ice push, ice shoves.
EVU
things like that, and offshore ridging, and then some kind of interesting nearshore dynamic stuff. Let me see if I think. Oh, somewhere here. No, I don't.
So what was...
I don't have it. I was looking for a particular piece of paper that I had. No, I took it downstairs. But it was just some interesting combination of near the ice moving in different directions close to shore. There were interesting things that turned up like that. Plus,
and what does that ice moving in different directions like that, why was that new, or
we hadn't seen it before.
And how is that useful?
Well, we didn't know. As a matter of fact, the reason I just pulled it out was we picked up somewhere in one of these reports there was a picture that I had sketched based on some of the radar stuff, and it showed ice coming in, pack ice coming in close to shore, and other ice running offshore, along shore at a much higher rate parallel to the shore. And we think we just saw something like that in the SAR radar from 2005 or something, but on a much larger scale. So, you never know. But it's the same sort of geometric relationship between ice moving in different directions. And it seems to have maybe something like that showed up again. I don't know. We'll find out eventually.
Yeah.
And then we looked at nearshore ice shoves. Like, we came up with some scheme for thinking about mechanisms for how these things might work in the winter. And that goes into that Beaufort Sea, one of the Beaufort Sea volumes. Mm-hmm. So, it's the usual sort of thing. You see something unusual and you think about it for a while and you eventually try and do something with it. But it was all new. Looking at the radar stuff was just new. Nobody's ever seen anything like that before. And so Bill and Jim wrote a paper about it. It went into a symposium volume in 1974. And then basically they left it, and I picked it up for the next 5 years. Mm-hmm. And we just ran it just to see what we could milk out of it.
Well, it's interesting that you got so into sea ice when that wasn't your background. How did you transition into understanding sea ice?
At that time, there was no place to learn sea ice, per se. And in fact, for a long time, it was always my impression. The people who came in to see, who were doing sea ice, were people who started out someplace else. There were very few who actually had training in it. In fact, Willie Weeks is a geologist.
Yeah.
You come across Willie's name.
I know his name, yeah.
Yeah, Willie's a geologist in geochemistry, in fact, petrology, hard rock.
And he's now known for ice.
He went over into that. There just weren't many people in it. And so there were lots of opportunities to do things, and there was a lot of demand for it, too. So once you started doing something and got a little bit of a reputation as knowing something, suddenly there were a lot of people knocking on the door.
And then you didn't have a choice, and you became the sea ice guy.
Yeah, well, but there were a number of people around. And Krell always was strong in that.
Yeah.
So, Austin Kovacs was there. And it was mainly Austin and Willie at that time, but there were others, too, but they were the main guys in sea ice. And they were working. They've been working up at Thule and Greenland and other places, and so on. So there was a lot. There was a core of people around. It just suddenly everything blossomed during.
Right. So you were in the right place at the right time.
Yeah. Yeah. Bill Hibbler started, I think, the same time. Mm-hmm. And there were people going to school in Dartmouth, and they could work through Krell.
Right.
So I think that's where Hibbler came through. I'm not sure. There were people.
I'm wondering.
And Gordon Cox is another one.
You were talking about how a lot of this funding came from the oil industry. They were interested in understanding ice and ice
they
dynamics.
They knew they needed to know things. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, they were worried about permafrost. There was subsea permafrost. They were thinking about, you know, drilling offshore because, you know, they could see from, I guess, from Prudhoe, from their, just the knowledge of the geology, that this whole thing was going to extend, you know, that the whole Prudhoe Bay field could extend offshore, that there would be offshore resources. And so they knew that they were going to have to go out and do something. So they were interested in learning about it. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think Sea Grant started. But once OCSEP came along, then the government had to do things because they had to write these environmental impact statements and set the standards for offshore structures and whatnot. And these were big things. I mean, at the time, there was a lot of money in those, you know. And, well, you know, it doesn't sound like big money now, but it was big money at the time, and there were a lot of things to learn.
Mm-hmm. Some people might wonder, how do you combine doing scientific research with doing work for the industry?
Well,
how did you reconcile those two things?
You were dealing with something that people didn't know. And so whatever you did was new. It was just that there were people looking over your shoulder for it, you know, for the information as fast as you could get it. But and they were interested in funding it. I mean, they would fund it just to speed it up. We did work for the industry on had separate projects going on at the same time. That industry funded that were basically became public. I mean, mm-hmm. it was not. They just wanted information.
So you felt you were able to still be independent
work. Oh, they used to come up and I mean, we had Exxon was up there. They would come up and spend time with us. People from different companies come up and kind of look over your shoulder for a while. That was fine. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, and we knew people in the industry. They were, and it was sort of. Almost encouraged because part of the game was to learn what they needed. I mean, mm-hmm. it wasn't just a question of, you know, of just the pure scientific interest in it. It was like, you know, what do we need to know? And in particular, what are we doing that we shouldn't be doing? In the sense that we didn't understand a lot about their work. And people mm-hmm. were worried about drilling fluids, you know. And, you know, toxicity of drilling fluids or things like that. And we had no idea because, you know, we weren't petroleum engineers. And so you needed to talk to them and say, how are you going to handle these things? So there was a fair amount of interchange. But it wasn't really, I don't see anything wrong with it at the time. I still don't think there was. I mean, it was just basically they were about the same level that we were.
Well, do you think some of the things you've found out helped them do things better, that they used your research
but it worked both ways. I mean, and then they jumped ahead of us. I mean, Exxon had, at that time, Exxon had really, they had top-notch people. Exxon and Shell both did. They were interested in the Arctic, but Exxon in particular, they had an engineering group there that would make a really good engineering faculty someplace in a good university. I mean, they were PhD engineers from good schools that were working on sea ice problems for a few years. But they did some big experimental programs that we eventually got. I mean, I had access to some of it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it was a lot of interchange. It wasn't anything that was anything that you would consider unethical. I mean, it was just people were trying to learn things.
Right.
They needed the information. Everybody needed it.
Right.
I mean, if you had responsibility for writing regulation, that's a really something that's really in the public interest.
Right. Well, that's why I was wondering if some of the things you found, if you...
Yeah, but not,
have
not,
you,
not
did
me.
You,
yeah.
Well, that research
yeah.
helped people understand. Is there any way you can connect that with, the industry took that information and did A, B, or C in a positive way?
There was, if you go over to the museum and look at this thing on under the, you know, this exhibit of Under the Ice, mm-hmm. Life Under the Ice, remember that? Mm-hmm. Did you see that over there? Okay. It's over in the museum.
In the old museum?
Well, it's in the new part. It's in the old part of the museum,
yeah.
But I'm not sure if it's still there. It was there a few years ago.
Yeah, I don't know. Okay.
But there's something there. A guy by the name of Ken Dutton did it. He was a graduate student here. Don Shell, they were working on these sorts of things. And, you know, it led to a lot of understanding of you know, these what do they call them? Well, they were just places under the ice where there were bare rocks and all sorts of animals living on these things that were not known to exist before. And, mm-hmm. and that had a lot of effect on where they, you know, where they could drill and how they operated mm-hmm. offshore and so on. It was there. So, I mean, there was a lot of interchange back and forth, and I never felt there was anything particularly wrong with it.
Well, what are some of the things you did research on that you thought brought out some new information?
Just some of the stuff on strength, mechanical properties, the way the ice deformed. I mean, it had influence on some of the programs, on one of the programs, I think, that was done. And we sort of showed some ways of doing things and testing. And then it was funny, one of these big ice shoves that came up on the beach, we were working along this thing and realized that depending on the slope of the beach, the way the ice reacted when it hit the beach was different. When it was steeper, it went to a certain angle, and I don't even remember what it was, but the ice would break up, whereas at a lower angle, it would come sliding up. And when Exxon first started their designing gravel islands, they used that angle as the preferred slope for the outside of the barrier of the gravel island, so that the ice would break up as it started to come up rather than slide. And of course, since then, after that, they learned how to make the slopes even steeper by sandbagging, reinforcing, and so on. So there was other ways of doing this stuff. But anyway, at the time, it was kind of interesting. In fact, I was kind of surprised at that, because I was at the seminar. I said, "Where'd you get that number from?" And they said, "From you." I didn't know it.
Well, and it's funny, when you talk about the angle of the beach and how the ice is going to climb up it in intuitively, it makes sense to me that those barrier islands out there that have such a low angle, the ice is really going to just go right up.
It does. We've seen that happen. It goes right across them.
Yeah, versus a steep embankment, it's going to hit.
Yeah, but that's not, yeah.
I mean, sort of seems intuitive.
Yeah, sure. But the thing is, we had a number. When the angle was over 30 degrees or something like that, it would break. If it was less than that, it would slide up.
Yeah. That's
and we
cool.
And we saw it just by going along the beach after a big shove and doing the measurements. Things like that. It seems like kind of trivial at the time, but it was important.
Well, but also maybe that's what science does, is there's something intuitive that seems to make sense, but you go and you prove it.
Mm-hmm.
You do this research.
Well, it was just an observation. I didn't prove anything.
Well,
I didn't do anything with it. I never did work it out enough to show that this should really happen. But the observation was enough, and that was enough for them. Somebody eventually worked on in fact, Exxon had the guys in Calgary. They were also busy, the Canadians.
Mm-hmm.
And SO Canada had a couple of really good guys working there, too. And there were people up there that were doing a lot, too.
Mm-hmm.
Just talking about it reminds me of them. That's why I'm kind of hesitant about doing this stuff, because there's a lot of people that I haven't thought about in years that all of a sudden I come out, I should have mentioned something about.
Well, I mean, those of us who, on my end, who do this kind of recording, we know it's not just one person, and it's always a team, and
just talking about it remind me of a whole series of things that were done by other people that I know,
what
I knew, but I just,
Well, you don't think about them.
You don't think about it until I just start talking about it now and say, gee, I should have given what's-her-name credit for doing that.
It's interesting that a lot of your work in those days, in the 70s, it was these ice shoves.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays, it seems more people are talking about ice breakoffs and breakouts.
Yeah. Well, that was something you can look at that now. And then we didn't really have much way of doing things with. We tried, but there was just wasn't much to work with.
In terms of what?
The radar's better now. They got better range. Did longer-term observation. In fact, the whole reason for this, for these interview things, the way that came about.
Oh, the historical references
that stuff.
Beaufort Sea Coast,
The way that came about was there was a big meeting. I'm trying to remember when it was. In the winter, I think, of 77 or 78 at Barrow. And we had the whole cluster of OCSEP investigators. We filled up NARL. There were guys there from the industry. There were seven or eight guys from the people from the industry. There were government people there. I mean, just the scientists working in OCSEP, plus industry engineers. And we were up there for 3 days, locked into that place. I mean, there were a lot of people. There was 80 or 90 people there.
Wow.
And three to a room. Everything was jammed up. And people arguing all night long about this and that and the other thing. And I say the industry was there too. And there were a bunch of local guys came in, and they were complaining that, well, here we're talking all about ICE, and you don't know anything about it. We know a lot about it because we've been dealing with this for a long time. And so what we didn't have was any kind of a record of what goes on near shore. How far back can you go? And, how often do these big ICE shows take place? Does the ICE ever go out real close to shore in the middle of the winter? Stuff like that. We didn't know things like that. But you'd need to know that if you were going to plan operations or something. So, it's the sort of thing. So the idea was that I went to Gunter, and I was, I talked to these guys, and they were really angry. And I go, I don't want to put names on them because I think I remember a few, but I don't. I'm not sure I have the right names, so I think I'll skip that part. But anyway, we're talking to them, and they were pretty upset about this and pretty adamant that they knew things that we didn't know. And so I went to Gunter, and I said, why don't we try to do this little interview thing? Do this thing and see if we can talk to some of the old-timers and see if they can remember things that will be useful and give us some, kind of push the historical record back a little bit beyond the last 3 or 4 years since people have been, regularly sitting here looking at this stuff. And so we put this thing together. Gunter came up with the funds for it. And they wrote a little budget. The budget included our first tape recorder. hired Kenny Tubeck, put him on it. Ron Metzner was the guy who did it because he was up there a lot. He was there all the time during our field seasons, and I was in and out. I'd be up there for 3 or 4 or 5 days at a time, and then he'd be up there. He was up there continuously. And so he was going to do some of it, and Kenny was going to do some. And eventually we got enough money to do the thing 1 year. I think it produced, I don't know, 5 or 6 interviews the first year. And then we did it for 1 more year after that. And we tried to find people who had interesting things to say. Then Kenny, in a couple of cases, Kenny went out by himself. Remember, there was somebody at Anaktubik Pass who had run dogs back and forth along the coast for years back in the 20s and earlier.
Yeah, that Elijah Kakinya.
Yeah. So, Kenny went up there to talk to him. We'd send him up there. That's the way it got done. We did 2 years of it, and then Kenny did the transliterations of the, and we wrote it up, and that was it.
Because the interviews that Kenny did, he spoke with the people in Inupiaq.
Yeah.
So then you needed it in English,
yeah.
Right?
But even then, some of the others they talked in. They did some of it in Inupiaq too, I guess. I don't know. I don't remember all of it.
Yeah, but some of the interviews are all in Inupiaq, and then some are in English.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing the ones that maybe Ron did were more of the English ones.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much. I thought Kenny was at most of those, I think.
Well, they may have done some together. Yeah. I don't know exactly either.
Yeah, I don't remember.
But
anyway,
I know there are some that are 100% Kenny and person in a new pack.
Yeah. So anyway, but everything we got was written up in those little reports.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as I say, the tapes from that eventually went to the library, and
right.
I think it was Edna McLean who wanted them because she wanted to look for some of the older words.
Mm-hmm.
How
was that project received by the local community? Did that?
Well, we tried to send it back to them, and then, of course, they picked it up right away and started doing it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so that started them up there.
Mm-hmm.
But we lost track of it after that because basically they wanted to run it themselves. They didn't want us around anymore.
So they started doing their own interview project?
Well, they would. They published something. It was a book somewhere that had one of our interviews in it, and they didn't mention where they got it from.
Oh.
I think they mentioned it was the first one.
Hmm. Well, it is true that once the borough was formed, they had their Inupiaq History, Language, and Culture Commission, and they did a lot of historic.
They started picking it up, and at that point, we were going to try and do something else, and basically, I have a vague recollection of that. I don't recall what it was about, but we wanted to try and do something, and they didn't want us involved in it.
Yeah. Oh, I think I know. They did lots of historic cultural reports on all kinds of different subjects. They didn't do it on sea ice per se. They did it on all kinds of things.
Yeah.
They did do one about the history of people who lived and traveled along the Beaufort Sea coast.
I don't know. I know it's
which fine. Maybe is because it would be some of the same area that
you. It might have been. I don't remember. But anyway, I remember being at one meeting at a village somewhere in at a house in Browerville where we talked about this stuff, but they weren't interested in having us participate at all. We could have put some money into it.
Right.
We could have, you know, because we had a little. We could have gotten a little more, but they weren't interested, and so we just dropped it. And that was the end of. So I never did any more with it than that. After that, and once we got those reports done, that was the end of it.
And do you know if the industry ever did anything with these reports? If it was useful?
I'm sure they were read.
If it was useful to anybody?
No idea. You never get any feedback from it. I mean, they had their own libraries and their own interests and their own things that they talked about internally. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you might meet somebody and informally talk about it, but that was all.
Yeah. So tell me, Ron Metzner, he worked for you?
Yeah, Ron was a graduate student. Well, let's see, he'd finished his master's, and he was working on getting a teaching certificate. So he worked for me up at Gnarl. He was up there for about 3 months a year. Well, I'd take more than that. We would normally go up there in January. The earliest we could hope to get out on the ice was usually sometime in January. Hmm. And we put a little Pulawanagan out on the ice a few hundred feet offshore. And that was basically our lab. Mm. And then everything we did were experiments, breaking ice. But on the, just around that, we use that space, mm-hmm. Use that Wanigan as a, you know, like an 8 by 16, it'd be about the size of this room here, something like that, or maybe a little bigger.
So a Wanigan was like a shed on tracks?
Yeah, a little shed on tracks, yeah. And they'd pull it out there as soon as they could get it out, which was usually sometime mid-January to late January when it would. They would say when it was safe, and mm-hmm. so they would pull it out, and then we just set up in there and use that for our lab space, and then worked on samples of ice that we cut outside, just outside the shed.
So you hopefully didn't cut so much. You still had stable ice around.
Oh
you.
Well, we were trying to break blocks of ice that were about 2 feet, about a 1 by 1 by 1 by 2 feet. That was the size we worked with. And we were breaking those to measure strength and properties and so on. Trying to learn how to do it was always a problem.
And so what did that
Well, it gave us strength,
you?
Strength, mechanical properties, ideas about behavior of ice. Sea ice is a kind of an interesting, well, all materials do it, you know. They'll creep at certain parts of their range, and other parts they just very elastic, break very quickly. Mm-hmm. So it's just trying to establish the general range of properties that you're likely to meet in the real world.
And does that relate to the Inupiaq talk about this Pikaluaq, which is the kind of the older, what they call freshwater ice, it's sort of the salt is leached out, and they say it shatters really easily.
Yeah, it's much more brittle once you get the salt out of the ice. But until you get the salt out, until the salt gets out, if it's going to do it, the ice has an easier capability to bend, to flow, although it doesn't really do that, but it gives the impression of flowing. It's like, you ever play around with silly putty?
Yes.
Okay. If you yank it real fast, it breaks. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you break it and look at the surface, what you see is something that looks very much like a piece of broken glass.
Uh-huh. Very brittle. Isn't it silicone?
No, if you break, if you pull it really fast, it breaks. It breaks like a brittle material. Mm-hmm. But if you leave it in one place and just set it on the corner of a table here, it'll flow over time. It'll just run down the side.
Or if you pull it very slowly.
Pull it very slowly. So the idea is that the properties and the way it responds to load depends on the rate the load is applied.
Oh.
And then you, on top of that, you can add in temperature effects and structural effects and so on, you know, depending on which direction you do this in, because the ice has directional properties as well.
Oh, it does.
Sea ice, yeah, has very strong directional properties. Huh. Top of a sea ice sheet is just a bunch of massive random crystals. By the time you get down, you know, 3-4 feet down into it, everything is lined up in the same direction. And it's very, very anisotropic. So it has a lot of different properties depending just as you go down through it. Hmm. And of course, the temperature changes as you go down through. Of course, the top is at air temperature, the bottom is at water temperature, which is not freezing. Yeah. And so you have all of these sort of variables that are potential variables that are piled on top of each other. And it makes the material difficult to work with. And that's what the engineers have to contend with, see, is, mm-hmm. you know, is ice in various states. So, and, you know, they have to take account of all of these things.
And so different months of the year when there is ice present, yeah. it makes a difference.
Yeah, different. Yeah, sure. The age of the ice, thickness of the age. There's just so many variables in it. Mm-hmm. That what they're looking at is always a limiting case of some sort. They want a structure that's going to stand. And the way they want to do that is, you know, you don't want big chunks of ice just banging into the sides of it. You want to figure out a way to make them make the ice fail, for example, or pile it up before it gets to the structure. There's all sorts of engineering considerations.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it's a difficult material to work with, and that's what makes the environment difficult. And so, I mean, they can overpower it. A gravel island that's done properly just overpowers it. There's no way the ice is going to have much effect. But at the time that they were even thinking about gravel islands, they knew that they would freeze partway down. You know, they get saturated, water gets down into them, they freeze, and the fear was always that somehow or other the top of it might freeze and you'd wind up with a great big hockey puck. You know, could get pushed. There was actually concern for a while that, you know, things like that could happen. So, and nobody really knew. So it was just, you know, it was very fundamental stuff that you had to learn along the way.
Yeah.
Will Harrison down here and Tom Ostkamp did a lot of work on subsea permafrost. Because there is permafrost under the sea.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, sure. There's permafrost offshore. Huh. And so, you know, you put a structure out there. It's the same thing as permafrost under a house here in Fairbanks.
Right.
You could have the same sort of problems,
right,
or particularly, not so much that, with pipelines, subsea pipelines
right.
and things like that.
You get that melting. And
yeah, lots of things can happen. So it's just a difficult environment, and nobody knew much about it. I mean, maybe these things aren't that much a concern now, but at that time, nobody knew what the concerns really were.
Well, and I would think now the environment is different now.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the sea ice environment, we all know, is different and is changing. So some of the strength and dynamics you were looking at now may be behaving differently.
Well, I don't know about that. I'm not sure if that's the case or not. It's just that the dominant thing would be that, you know, well, you can't really say. You know, there's differences in the history in the sense of age of the ice. I don't know.
I'm thinking about the, you know, people say the ice is thinner now, or there's no longer these big pieces ice.
I'm not sure that they're not coming back.
How the ice reacts?
Well, that's a very different. It's a difficult thing because it's a scale effect. Whereas these big multi-year flows, I mean, these things can be, you know, 50 kilometers across. And that's one big chunk of ice. I mean, that's an infinite ice sheet as far as you're concerned if you're sitting on a structure and this thing is coming at you. On the other hand, you know, if you got a bunch of multi-year ice, small pieces or something frozen into a bunch of first-year ice, it's a different material.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just got a sheet of first-year ice that's a few weeks old versus one that's 3 months old or something, it's a different material. So you kind of have to, what the engineers are thinking about is they want to know what's the worst possible case. And that's what they have to worry about. But on the other hand, you don't want to overdo it, because when you start building, you know, you put a structure out or something and it costs, you know, X number of dollars. If you want to increase the safety factor by factor of, you know, 1.2 or 1.5 or something, you can be increasing it by, you know, the cost of the thing by 20, 30, 40, 50%. And when you're dealing with those kinds of numbers, those are huge numbers.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you're aware, you know, but when you get a big hurricane down the Gulf, they lose, the rigs disappear.
Right.
Okay. The reason why is because they design these things as a statistical chance that they're going to lose a rig in a hurricane. If you built every rig that goes out there to sustain the, you know, the worst possible hurricane, it's incredibly expensive. So instead what they do is they design rigs that they know they get enough warning when the hurricane's coming, that you can just shut them down, close everything off on the mud line, get everybody off, and then hope it's going to be there when they get back.
Mm-hmm.
And that turns out to be economically the way to do these things, okay?
Mm-hmm. But in the Arctic.
But you can't do it in the Arctic.
Because you don't know, you don't have a forecast of there's an ice push-up coming.
Yeah, and also the cost is so much greater of an individual structure. Right. At least that's, you know, I'm going back now. This is 25, 30 years ago that I'm talking about.
And that's why we're saying that the environment and the types of ice conditions they are dealing with now.
And the structure, and the types of structures and things they try to do. The engineers have, they've moved a lot.
Everybody keeps moving. The science is changing, and the engineering changes the environment is changing.
Sure.
You know, you have to all keep up with that.
Yeah.
And that's why I say it. You know, it seems like all those ice shoves and push-up events that you studied, it seems like they're not happening as much.
Oh yeah,
now
they're happening more.
Are they?
Oh yeah, yeah. It's more active. That's one of the things that they'll say. Is that the ice is more active? No, I don't. You know, I don't keep track of it anymore, and I don't do those things. I'm not the statistics that way. But I've been looking for the life of ever since. Well, I don't know. 2002, 2003. We've had these projects with BLM looking at ice conditions in the Beaufort Sea and the Chukchi Sea, because they have to write information just to write regulations for. Offshore strike, you know, again for these lease sales that they've had up there, you know, they've sold leases in the eastern Beaufort Sea and off the Chukchi coast of Alaska, and so they need to know what's going on. The industry has put money into that too. That kind of joint government industry programs, you know, and this is an example of what I mean. They need to write regulations, and everybody needs the same information. Mm-hmm. So they've gone cooperatively on some of it, but I've been looking at I've been looking mainly at the AVHRR stuff, NOAA satellites.
AVHRs, okay,
I've been looking at those, and I've spent, I don't know, several years now. That's what I've been doing. I mean, I come in and just...
You come and look at your computer here in the office.
Yeah, well, see, that's an AVHRR picture from this April this year. Mm-hmm. I was just sort of flipping down through those when you came in. But, I've been looking at these things now, and I did one study on just the Chukchi Sea, and then one of them on the Beaufort.
And so what are you looking for? What do these satellite images tell you?
Well, I'm looking for patterns of deformation, the way the ice moves around, lead patterns, how frequently they form, what they look like, general characteristics of ice motion that you can get off these. I've looked at... Well, 20 years worth of data, the whole time that we've been collecting this stuff. Probably 250 days a year when the ice is there.
Wow.
I look at one picture for every day, one picture separately for the Chukchi, one picture for the Beaufort, and it comes to something like 10,000 pictures that I've looked at.
Well, that's a wonderful. So what have you learned?
It's kind of overwhelming, but... the idea is just I can identify patterns. They repeat. There's certain laws, certain geometric factors about the nature of the coasts and so on that tell you the way this thing, you know, that give you some ways to interpret sort of things that happen. Like, for example, ice getting shoved out through Bering Strait. You know, that's a feature that everybody knows. A lot of people know about it. It's common. But there are other things that happen up there as well. And so you can look at them, and it turns out that there are even interesting things about something like the Bering Strait, these arches pushing, the ice pushing out through Bering Strait. They're interesting things people didn't realize that you pick up just by look, because you look at the picture every day. For example, the arch will start growing and it'll suddenly veer off into a different direction. I mean, just breaking ice and suddenly it's going off in a different direction because it turns and it breaks off in the it tends to expand in the direction that the pack ice is coming from. So there'll be times when the arch will grow up to here. Sometimes it'll go straight across the Chukchi. Sometimes it bends and goes up along the coast.
And that's happening because of how the ice is pushing it?
No, it's because of the way the ice reacts. It's just the mechanics of the ice.
So it's got nothing to do with the winds and the currents?
Well, I mean, those are what's driving the pack ice. And this is just simply the way the ice breaks. It's simply a mechanical pattern. It's understood.
And so by looking at all these patterns, is that... give you some confidence in being able to predict? Like, oh, I see this happening. I'm going to guess it's now going to do this in a couple days.
No, because that depends on the weather.
Okay.
But if you look at these things long enough, what you'll find is that you're going to see the same things over and over and over again. And that's because what doesn't change, the coastlines are the same. You get fast ice along the edge. So the shapes of the coastlines with respect to the ice don't change. Ice grows every year, and it goes away every year. Mm-hmm. And it follows, meaning you have to freeze it, you have to melt it away, you have to get rid of it. Weather patterns that go across there are fairly consistent. That's why you have prevailing winds.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're dealing with a sort of a system where you have fixed boundaries or relatively fixed boundaries. Currents, probably, I don't know how much we understand about those in detail, the way to interpret something like that. But the winds are pretty consistent from year to year. Mm-hmm. I mean, if the weather patterns go across, the winds are not always the same. But that's why you talk about things like prevailing winds.
Right. Okay. Well, the other thing I'm wondering, too, is, well, you see, you know, there's always ice. But now, in some places, you know, ice doesn't form till later in the season. And therefore, it's thinner than it used to be and along the coastline.
Yeah.
And so is that affecting those patterns?
I can't see that. I can't tell that because I don't have a way of measuring that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it's all in my head, so to speak. I have to, you know, I have to go back and I'll look at a picture, look at a series and say, I've seen something that before. Where? And I have to go back and sift through, you know, 5 years of pictures or something before I see, oh, there it is, the same thing. But you can see, I mean, some of them are just almost identical from year to year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, literally, they're the same things over and over again. But not every year. I mean, maybe 5 years apart. It just depends when things are right at the right time of year,
mm-hmm.
and the ice conditions are right and the weather systems are just right.
Well, an example, I don't know if you've seen it. I just saw, I don't know what kind of imagery. I don't know, satellites versus blah, blah, blah. But there was this big ice break-off event in Barrow sometime in the last couple of days. That just happened last year, too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It all goes out.
Well, it has to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you stop and think about it, it really should. The only question is, you know, for somebody to spend enough time looking at these things to say, okay, this is a typical sort of pattern. This is what happens.
Mm-hmm.
This is the way this thing works. And there are certain ways you can develop this and so on, certain steps that you can go through to get to it.
I'm just wondering if those patterns are changing.
No way to measure. I mean, I can't measure them. I mean, basically where I am now, I suppose that it takes somebody that's better with these machines than I am and has better, you know, more access to it and more time to worry about
mm-hmm.
it. I mean, you know, somebody had to do the first step.
Right.
I mean, I can show you that they change, that they're there.
Well, didn't you also do something, one of the first people to use Landsat images as well?
Oh.
What was that about?
Well, that was...
I don't know the difference between...
Well, Landsat was the first of the satellites that we... Let me see. No, let me just... I'll give you. Where is it? Do I have it in here? No, I took it off. Wait, no, maybe. No, it's not in here anymore. Oh, I had some stuff that I might be able to show you pretty easy. Let's see. No, I don't really have it here. I might have it here. Hold on. I'm trying to find this one thing. I just did a talk on this a couple of weeks ago. This thing is misbehaving.
Computers never behave when we want them to.
Yeah, I'm trying to get
that's okay.
That's all right. Anyway, where is it? No, there's one thing here. One place. Oh, no, it's not here. It's at home, I think. It's got to be here. No, I don't have it here. Anyway, I had some notes. I can't get into that one thing up there called Dropbox. I don't know what's wrong with it. Every time I get up on that lake, see, it doesn't like me.
It's thinking.
No, it's
not thinking.
I think it's thinking. I think it doesn't like it for some reason. It doesn't want me to get in there.
Hmm.
I've used it a lot. But anyway,
this,
yeah.